This is VOA News coming to you by remote. I'm Gene Randall. Russian political dissident Alexei Navalny is hospitalized in Berlin after being flown there today from Siberia on an ambulance aircraft. German doctors had traveled to the city of Omsk yesterday to evacuate Navalny, a longtime opponent of Russian President Vladimir Putin. The 44-year-old Navalny, a campaigner against corruption, collapsed on a flight to Moscow Thursday after drinking tea widely believed by his allies to have been laced with poison. After first saying he could not be evacuated because of his condition, and after Navalny's wife appealed to the Kremlin to intervene, the chief of the Siberian hospital relented, and Alexei Navalny at this hour is a patient at Berlin's Charité Hospital. Navalny backers who arranged the rescue flight say his condition is stable but worrying. South Korea says it's held talks in the city of Busan with a top Chinese diplomat, Yang Jiechi, a member of the Communist Party Politburo. Centered on trade, nuclear issues, and the response to the coronavirus, the talks involved the first South Korean visit by a high-level Beijing official since the pandemic erupted in China late last year. The two countries resumed exchanges last month when Seoul sent a ranking diplomat to China for a bilateral economic meeting. Two tropical storms expected to become hurricanes are headed for the Gulf of Mexico coast of the United States and should strengthen over the Gulf's warm waters at the same time. It is a rare weather event that could cause massive damage as the storms make landfall. The National Weather Service says there have never been two hurricanes in the U.S. Gulf simultaneously. The official word is that both current systems look on track to remain separate, but that any interaction between the two could heighten their intensity. The United States says it's suspending military cooperation with the African nation of Mali in response to the overthrow of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta. The ousting of Keïta this week has dismayed Mali's international partners, who fear it could further destabilize the former French colony, which is already battling a militant Islamist threat. This is VOA News. The six-member Gulf Cooperation Council today welcomed a ceasefire announcement in Libya and called on all parties to adhere to it. The aim, said the council, is to reach a permanent and comprehensive solution to the fighting in the North African nation. Libya's internationally recognized government in Tripoli announced the ceasefire yesterday, and the leader of a rival parliament in eastern Libya also appealed for a halt to hostilities. South Africa's confirmed COVID-19 cases today surpassed 600,000, the highest number on the African continent. Despite imposing one of the world's toughest lockdowns at the end of March, when it had only a few hundred cases, South Africa has since seen a surge in infections. The South Africa figures from Johns Hopkins University, some 603,000 cases and close to 13,000 deaths. The worldwide COVID numbers are closing in on 23 million, with fatalities moving up from 800,000. Here in the U.S., 5.6 million people have fallen ill, while the virus has killed 175,000 plus. Brazil is the next on the list of victims. The death toll there now tops 113,000, with a case count of 3.5 million. The hardest hit city is Manaus, which has lost 23,000 lives to the virus. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has consistently refused to support lockdowns aimed at stemming the spread of the disease. South Korea says it's once again banning large gatherings, closing beaches, shutting down nightclubs and churches, and removing spectators from sports events. All of this in the face of new coronavirus outbreaks. For the ninth straight day, South Korea has reported triple-digit increases in case numbers, most traced to the area in and around Seoul. Cases in South Korea total 17,000, with 309 deaths. Australia's second most populous state, Victoria, reported 13 new coronavirus deaths in the past 24-hour period, but health authorities say new infections remain below 200 for the second consecutive day. Australia has seen 24,600 COVID cases with a loss of 485 lives. The UN nuclear watchdog's chief, Rafael Grossi, will make his first trip to Iran in that role. That according to Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, who says on Twitter, quote, "We hope this visit will lead to reinforced mutual cooperation. The two sides currently are in a standoff over access to a pair of Iranian sites." The newest Ebola outbreak in the Western Democratic Republic of Congo has infected 100 people and taken nearly half their lives. The latest cluster of cases was declared on June 1st in the city of Bandundu with 1 million people. That was just before Congo declared the end of a previous outbreak in the east, which had dragged on for 2 years. More news online at voanews.com for your convenience. There is also an easy-to-use mobile app. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
As we go on involving these political parties that are participating, to make sure that we are on the same page. And this is the promise that Tanzanians will participate in a fair, free, transparent and a democratic election as it has been before.
Officials of the Tanzanian National Electoral Commission meet civil society group Saturday.
Ideally, the expectation would be to have a free and fair election that can return a president with the people's mandate. But that is a pipe dream considering the environment obtaining in the country right now.
The Lord Mayor of Kampala says Uganda's next year's general election is unlikely to be credible.
What I want to see done and what we intend to do in our government is to ensure that there is a zero tolerance for corruption. We would punish people at the very highest levels, jail those we need to jail, and recover assets that we need to recover. It is the only way people can begin to take a cue.
And an independent Ghanaian presidential candidate outlines his vision for the country, as well as plans to combat corruption. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Officials of the Tanzanian National Electoral Commission, or NEC, plan to meet representatives of civil society groups and other stakeholders Saturday. Over 200 groups have sought permission from the electoral body to be part of the campaign to educate prospective voters ahead of the upcoming October general election. Dr. Charles Wilson, Director of Elections at the Electoral Commission, says key on the agenda will be a discussion about electoral guidelines. Saturday's meeting comes days after the Electoral Commission also met with religious leaders. Wilson says the electoral body is working closely with them to encourage their congregants to be part of the electoral process. Wilson tells me that the National Electoral Commission plans to also meet with all political parties to address their concerns. He adds that the electoral body is implementing measures to ensure the upcoming polls are transparent and fair.
The agenda is that some civil societies had applied to be permitted to undertake voters' education countrywide, and 246 CSOs were permitted by NEC to undertake voters' education countrywide. So the forthcoming meeting therefore aims to exposing the CSOs to voters' education guidelines, because NEC has got guidelines. These civil society groups will have to abide to. So it also aims to at creating common understanding on voters' education, what it is, what it is not. Furthermore, it will serve as a forum for updating them on the stage at which preparations for the 2020 general elections has reached so far.
The National Electoral Commission recently met with religious leaders. What were discussed and what was the major takeaway from the meeting?
The meeting was quite good. So the meeting with the religious leaders had several goals. One was to provide a report on the preparations for the 2020 general election. Two, religious leaders as key stakeholders for NEC, so to underline their contribution in maintaining peace and raising voter turnout, because they can be very helpful to encourage their followers to turn out on the election day. So basically, it was seeking to forge a mutual relationship for the forthcoming election so that during the 2020 general election, then the electoral process and we have to go on smoothly.
What is the level of preparation for the National Electoral Commission in anticipation of the upcoming October general election in Tanzania?
The preparation is quite good because the election is just a process. So we started preparing since 2018. In 2019, and so far, the progress in terms of preparations is quite good. So we have completed updating the permanent national voters register, and it has advertised several tenders for various items, and to date, some of them have been delivered. We have appointed the people who will participate in the election process, but also we have trained them for those officials who will be involved in the managing various election processes. But we have also accredited about 97 local election observers and recently also 18 international observers. The results will be out probably next week. So we are in the final stages of accrediting international actual election observers, almost done. We will give them letters soon. But NEC has completed the designing and installing of several systems that we will be using for this election. And we started this nomination process, which will be terminated and will end on the 25th of August. So we are thereafter, we shall start campaigning from 26th August to 27th October. So we are in the right track.
What are some of the measures that the Electoral Commission has implemented to ensure transparency in the electoral process?
Transparency actually involves several things, including involving many various stakeholders. So that's why you see we are meeting with various stakeholders. We met with the religious people. We are going to meet with those NGOs. We are going to meet with the local observers that have been permitted to observe this election. And we are going to conduct the general election, 2020 election, by actually managing the electoral processes according to the stipulated electoral laws, guidelines, the Constitution of the United Republic of Tanzania. Also for the purpose of transparency, both international and local observers have been invited. So not only that, but we are going also to involve, you know, as we go on involving these political parties that are participating to make sure that we are on the same page. And this is the promise that Tanzanians will participate in a fair, free, transparent and a democratic election as it has been before.
Dr. Charles Wilson is the Director of Elections at the Tanzania National Electoral Commission, or NEC. He spoke with me from the capital, Dodoma. The Lord Mayor of Uganda's capital, Kampala, says next year's general election is unlikely to be credible. Erias Lukwago, who recently joined the main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, says a key objective of his new party is to liberate the country from President Yoweri Museveni and his governing party, the National Resistance Movement, or NRM. His remarks come after Dr. Chisa Besigye, the FDC founding member and regular presidential candidate for the party, announced he will not lead the party in next year's presidential poll. He cited voter irregularities, rigging, and the lack of independence of the Electoral Commission among the reasons why he will not compete in the presidential election. To learn more about the Lord Mayor of Kampala's decision to join the FDC and the electoral prospects of the party in next year's polls, I reach Erias Lukwago.
I had issues with the leadership in my former party, the Democratic Party. There were irreconcilable differences which couldn't be addressed within the internal systems and mechanisms of the party. I have to move on. And then why FDC? Because I've been working with the colleagues who started the party and the leadership of the party and the members who are there, and also the vision and the values that they espouse, and of course also the mission we have always pursued together of liberating the country and also addressing issues of democracy, issues of inequity. Those are some of the ideals that we share together. And I felt, yes, this is the team I should continue working with. And then we continue advancing the struggle.
What unique set of skills do you bring to the party that you think would help the electoral prospect of the party in next year's elections?
Well, frankly speaking, we are not so much focusing on the electoral fortunes of the party per se, no. Because the issues at hand right now, in as much as, yes, the electoral season is with us right now, and in as much as, yes, as a party, we have to front candidates in this election exercise, but the central focus is about liberation of the country, a country which under captivity, faced with bad governance, so with repression and suppression. Those are the issues we are focusing on, because we have a leader who has been in power for the last 35 years and is still counting. He's not about to let go. And he has monopolized the political space.
Are you therefore saying that you, as well as your party, the FDC, do not necessarily believe that next year's election will be fair, transparent, and credible?
We have not missed words on that. The Constitution commands that we must have a free and fair election. But what is being organized by the Electoral Commission right now is a sham exercise which does not meet the constitutional test standard. That is it.
Mr. Lord Mayor, what will be the function of opposition parties in Uganda if, as you described, and that the political space is narrowed? How effective will you be in bringing about change that you seek?
Well, that's the $1 million question. Of course, it's one of the issues that are bothering us, the efficacy of the opposition political parties in the political processes of the country. Conventionally, political parties are supposed to aggregate interests and also come up with the political agenda, and also participate in elections. But we are not dealing with a normal exercise. We are not talking about a conventional electoral process. What we are dealing with, we have described it as a military junta disguised as a democratic government. That's what we are dealing with. So the efficacy of the opposition in the politics depends on the way we appreciate the realities on the ground. And that's the reason for us in the FDC and the People's Government. We continue to present that case to the people of Uganda to appreciate that we are under captivity, to appreciate that we have a military junta in the place, and to appreciate that there is no constitutional rule or governance in the country. And therefore, that calls for other measures to be taken, which are also enshrined within the Constitution. In Article 3 of our Constitution, we are given the latitude, the wide latitude as citizens of the country, that in an environment like this, where you are faced with a military junta which has no respect for the constitutional order, you have to use whatever means you have to deal with that particular situation.
What should be the expectations of the people of Uganda ahead of next year's election?
Ideally, the expectation would be to have a free and fair election that can return a president with the people's mandate. But that is a pipe dream, considering the environment obtaining in the country right now. So what is going to happen, obviously, is for Mr. Museveni to have an exercise that is going to legitimize the life presidency. That's what we should expect.
Erias Lukwago is the Lord Mayor of Uganda's capital, Kampala. He spoke with me from Kampala. Merrick Kofi Gani is a management consultant, chartered accountant, and author. He has also declared plans to contest in Ghana's upcoming December polls as an independent presidential candidate. Ghanaians go to the polls in December to choose a new president, parliament, and local representatives. Political analysts say Mr. Gani faces a daunting task of breaking the electoral dominance of the two major parties, the governing New Patriotic Party, NPP, and the main opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, or NDC. To become president, Mr. Gani has to defeat incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo from the NPP and the main opposition leader, former President John Dramani Mahama from the NDC. To learn more about his vision for Ghana and plans to resolve challenges facing the country, I reach Merrick Kofi Gani.
My vision for this country is quite straightforward. We want to build a Ghana that works for every single Ghanaian, not just a few who are in power. And so I want to see a Ghana that ensures that young people are being educated in a manner that makes them ready for the future. I want to see businesses flourish because there is no vindictiveness in the government we want to operate. We want to see Ghana become the economic hub for West Africa, where you cannot do business in West Africa without going through Ghana. We want to ensure that the systems work, that the constitution sees a review to ensure that it's beginning to grow in line with the evolution of Ghanaians. So in large part, we just want to build a society, a Ghana that works for everybody.
Since you started campaigning and reaching out to Ghanaians or prospective voters, what has been the response so far about their support for you in the upcoming elections?
The response has been phenomenal, actually, in most cases, mind-blowing, I must say. It's largely come from the youth, the very middle class. And in these days, we're seeing quite a lot of very old people who have said to me in some cases that, look, we made a lot of mistakes with the NDC and the NPP, and we think that you're a better option for us to leave a legacy with for our children and our children's children.
Some political analysts are saying that Ghana is sharply divided into two major political powerhouses, the governing New Patriotic Party and the main opposition in the National Democratic Congress. How do you plan on breaking this dominant forces in order to become the next president of Ghana?
If we listen to what Ghanaians are saying, the economy of the individual pockets are crying. Their personal, you know, circumstances are not the best. And most of the Ghanaians you speak to these days will point blankly tell you, we are tired of the NDC and we are tired of the NPP. So I understand what the political analysts are saying. Obviously, they are using trends and the rest. But if you speak to the Ghanaians, who I again say are more than the political analysts, they are saying a totally different thing. And for most people, they just want to see something different happen to their livelihoods. They want to see something different happen to their personal economies. Are going to be the deciding factor in this year's election.
The people you've met, the young people, the middle class, what are some of the challenges they've mentioned to you as the first step to resolve in order for them to realize or have an aspiration to meeting the solutions that you proffer to them?
Well, there are very varied things I have come across. I mean, if you go to, say, the rural areas, for example, one of the big things they will tell you is that several governments, successive governments in the last 27 years have gone ahead and do what they assume is development without consulting them. I have been to villages where they've told me, well, they want to build a new dam. The truth is, we don't need a new dam. We've just been asking for them to deseal this dam for many, many years. So it's that disconnection that the rural people feel between government and what is real rural issues. If you talk to the young people, they will tell you their education is not giving them the ability to match what industry is requiring and the efficiency or the competency that is needed in this industry. And if you talk to international business people, they will tell you that the level of corruption in Ghana is so much so that they cannot plan when trying to figure out what their finances should be like when they want to come and invest in Ghana.
One of the things you mentioned right now is the fight against corruption. How do you plan on combating the issue and the perception of corruption in Ghana?
I think one of the biggest problems we've had in this country is that the corruption in Ghana is not entirely just systemic, it is political. What I want to see done and what we intend to do in our government is to ensure that there is a zero tolerance for corruption. We would punish people at the very highest levels, jail those we need to jail, and recover assets that we need to recover. It is the only way people can begin to take a cue that the punishment for engaging in corruption far outweighs the benefit that is derived from going about.
Mary Kofi Ghana is an independent presidential candidate in the December 7 Ghanaian general election. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Still in Ghana, the National Peace Council has launched a nationwide program to ensure that upcoming elections are peaceful. The organization has also called on the police to thoroughly investigate reports of pockets of violence during the recently concluded voter registration process. Those found to have planned and carried out the attack, the group says, should be made to face the full force of the law and serve as a deterrent. This after local media reports of politically related violence as the Electoral Commission compiled a voter list to be used for the polls. The National Peace Council, however, expressed satisfaction with the conduct of the voter registration process. To learn more about the call for the investigation and efforts by the Peace Council to bring about peaceful elections, I reached Reverend Emmanuel Asante, chairman of the Ghanaian National Peace Council.
The voters registration exercise was very, very successful as far as I'm concerned. A lot of people, including the political parties themselves, have accepted that it was very successful. However, there were pockets of violence here and there that calls for police action, because we have an act that goes against political thuggery. And to the extent that somebody lost his life as a result of voters' registration and some people got hurt, I hear that in some other places cars were burnt and people were beating, there is the need for the police to speed up their investigation. We call for that. We're not asking them to tell us how they are doing their investigations, because investigation on criminal actions are things that the police might not want to divulge to the public. But at least the public need to know that people cannot do these things and get away with it. And that's what we are urging, what we are urging the police to do.
Reverend Asante, how are Ghanaians responding to this education and sensitization campaign that the organization has launched in order to be mindful of their action when it comes to issues of political related violence in the run-up to the election?
The public is receiving the education that we are offering. Places where we have been, we have had very positive response from those who have taken part in the workshops. And we believe that as we continue to do this, we're going to get a lot of people understand the issues at stake. So it's an encouragement to the National Peace Council and to the other institutions committed to educating the public on these matters. We believe that as we continue to do this, the public will understand. Because, you see, if you look at the vigilante bill that has been passed by Parliament, anybody who is caught on the wrong side of the law, and if you're caught with a weapon, you go to prison for 15 to 25 years. A lot of people say, oh, a lot of people do this and they get away with it. And that's why we are telling the police to let the public know what is going on. Because I know that some people have been prosecuted, but the public do not know a lot about what is going on. Hence, I call on the police to make sure that they expedite these things and also to set up platforms. In fact, places where we have been, as we have discussed these things with them and they get to hear what is going on, young people in particular who come in begin to say, hey, we need to be very careful about these things.
Asante, what is your reaction to critics of the administration who are of the view and express concern that the deployment recently of military during the voter registration process was aimed to intimidate and harass their supporters from registering or participating during the voter registration process?
Long before the registration, I knew that the government had deployed forces to the borders of our country. If you know what is happening in the West African sub-region, we have a problem of the jihadist encroachment. And in Burkina Faso, for instance, a greater percentage of that country is in the hands of the jihadists. Any responsible government will not sit down and think that it is happening to them, so it cannot happen to us. And therefore, you look at our borders, it's too porous. And the few border, the immigration people who were put there will not be in a position to actually man all the borders. And so it became necessary to deploy the military people to go into these areas. Now, as to what the question of soldiers have been deployed to intimidate so that people will not be able to register, look at the numbers that registered and compare it to the previous voters register. About 60 million plus. Of course, I mean, they're doing they are now doing validation, and I'm sure that the numbers might reduce. But the Electoral Commission even exceeded their own expectations. It means that people were not prevented from registering.
Reverend Emmanuel Asante is the chairman of the Ghanaian National Peace Council. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Nigeria, defense lawyer for Ibrahim Magu, the suspended acting chairman of the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, or EFCC, is demanding a fair hearing as a presidential panel investigates allegations of corruption against his client. Wahab Shitu says the presidential panel should provide copies of all relevant evidence in the case to the defense team and Mr. Magu. He says that's part of a constitutional requirement that has to be met by the presidential panel. The defense lawyer also says Magu's rights were violated after he was detained for 10 days. Magu's supporters say it appears that his anti-graft crusade to combat endemic corruption has ruffled some feathers. They add that corruption is now rebounding with a vengeance. This after they dismissed allegations of corruption against Magu as a ploy to get rid of him so they can continue to embezzle public funds. Defense attorney Shitu tells me that his client continues to be mistreated, adding that allegations of corruption reported in the media against Magu are proving to be false.
The first point I want you to note, we are talking of a subject who has a local and international reputation for his efforts against corruption. Mr. Magu was accosted on the street. He was served a letter of invitation and asked to follow them straight away. He was taken before the panel from the spot of his invitation. So that's the first thing you should also ponder about, whether the manner of arrest or the manner of invitation is consistent with the fundamentals of the democratic tradition. And the third issue, which is also important, is that repeatedly since his appearance, he has personally requested for copies of allegations against him. He has also repeatedly done so through his counsel. And up till now, a panel that was constituted standing third of July and has been sitting ever since is here to formally present allegations to Mr. Ibrahim Magu, even as I speak.
Are you therefore saying Ibrahim Magu's fundamental human right to justice was violated in him being placed in custody and the processes that led to it?
I'm saying that the only thing going for Mr. Ibrahim Magu is his innocence and is willing to proclaim that to the rooftops. No one is questioning the prerogative of whoever to appoint and remove the chairman of the FCC. But every individual deserves to have his reputation protected. And when anybody is accused of any offense, it should be a very full details of the allegations against him. That has not been done until now. Now, the question you also want to ask yourself is that which body is actually trying it?
I understand you have petitioned the panel to furnish you with allegations against Mr. Magu. What was the rationale behind it? And didn't the panel tell you why they are doing the investigation in the first place?
The answer of the panel to me is that they were not served the copies of terms of reference on the 35 days later, and that they are not trying Magu, that they are just on a fact-finding mission, that they are just an administrative panel, an investigation committee. But we found out 35 days later that that representation is untrue, that it is actually a judicial commission of inquiry that is meant to hold its sittings in public and allow legal representation. I, as counsel that has been appearing for Magu since the inception of the proceeding, was not given access to cross-examine witnesses until 3 or 4 days ago. Initially, the right to cross-examine, even when they allow legal access, was given to Magu himself, while his counsel was just sitting down, watching proceedings like a zombie. So it was only recently, when we now know that it's a judicial commission of inquiry, that we insisted that counsel must be allowed to cross-examine witnesses. And that was when the request was granted. So the question you want to ask yourself is, why was the counsel to Magu denied the right to cross-examine witnesses from the inception of the proceedings? That's a gross violation of the Constitution. Yes.
What is your next line of action or the investigation ongoing against Mr. Ibrahim Magu?
Our first is to believe that the falsehood being orchestrated in the media remain what it is, rumor, falsehood, because Magu, my client, has not been indicted and cannot be indicted because the man is innocent. So what we intend to do is to draw the attention of the Commission of Inquiry to the falsehood being peddled in the public space. A panel that is set up to sit in public cannot also submit whatever report in private. They are supposed to sit in public. They are supposed to take evidence of witnesses on oath. I also to draw the attention of the panel to it. At the relevant stage of the proceedings, we will also examine other legal options. Magu has defense, solid watertight defense to every allegation that has been published against solid watertight, incontrovertible defense, backed with incontrovertible documentary material.
Wahab Shitu is the defense lawyer for Ibrahim Magu, the suspended acting chairman of the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, or EFCC. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, sectarian violence has plagued the country's Kaduna state for decades, claiming thousands of lives and forcing thousands more from their homes. In late July, gunmen killed at least 43 people in the southern part of Kaduna, pushing the death toll to 178 from violence in the region this year. The Nigerian government has deployed more security forces, but local community leaders and rights groups accuse the authorities of willful neglect. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from a village in Kaduna that was recently attacked.
It's a roughly three-hour drive from the main city of Kaduna to Krumi Masara village in southern Kaduna state, the latest hotspot for the sectarian violence that seems to plague northwestern Nigeria. Dozens of people were killed there during an overnight raid that lasted nearly 6 hours during the pre-dawn hours of August 6. Like other survivors, Michael Bagudu counts his losses while scouring through burnt ruins, looking for remnants of his life. They came with two trucks and carted away my food, couch, mattresses. They came several times, and when they had taken all they wanted, they burned the house. Another survivor, Martina Andrew, barely escaped through the bushes to a nearby village in Nasarawa when gunmen raided her home in Kaduna. She groans as she says her husband and two sons were killed before the house burned to the ground. They came that night chanting, "The land is ours, the governor is ours." They killed my children and said they'd return and kill us all. The fighting in southern Kaduna is mainly between nomadic settlers or herders and farmers. Issues around land use and ownership are the root cause of the crisis, but the sects are also divided along religious lines. An informal camp for displaced people that began with about 900 residents is now home to more than 3,500, says camp head Reverend Kambo Waziri.
It started actually on personal ground. We are not attached to any organization. We are not attached to any body. We are not attached to the government. It just started out of the compassion we have for these people that are passing through all these things.
Nigerian authorities have deployed special forces to several flashpoints in the region and have so far arrested 8 suspects. Security experts like Kabir Adamu blame Nigeria's justice system for the recurring violence.
Over time, when the first set of killings occurred, the criminal justice system failed to arrest the perpetrators or the instigators and to punish them, unfortunately. The deterrence factor within our criminal justice system never worked. Others who saw no one was punished, they also decided to start doing the same thing.
Unless peace is restored, many more villages are at risk of attack, and victims like Martina will be away from home for a long time. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Southern Kaduna in Northwest Nigeria.
Botswana has decided to rearm its wildlife rangers as the southern African country battles increased cases of poaching. In the last 6 months, at least 17 poachers have been killed in gunfire exchanges with the army. For VOA, Nkodisi Dube reports from the Botswana capital, Habaroni.
The government disarmed wildlife rangers in 2018, saying that under the law, only the military was allowed the use of firearms during anti-poaching patrols. With the country losing 56 rhinoceros to poachers in the last 2 years, the government is reconsidering that approach. Wildlife and Tourism Minister Phil Dagiring recently told Parliament the government is amending the law that prevented the rangers from carrying weapons. National Assembly legislator Koborego Nkawana introduced a debate in Parliament over the need to rearm the officers.
This unit has for many years looked after the wildlife of Botswana endangered species such as rhinos were properly looked after adequately. And since the disarmament, the population has gone down, poaching has gone up.
Ngawana had argued that legislation already gives rangers the right to use firearms.
The law provides for wildlife personnel to carry arms where necessary. And this empowers the director of wildlife at national parks to determine when they need such arms to be used where.
Former Rhino Conservation Botswana Director Mabe Ives welcomes moves to rearm the anti-poaching officers.
I have long said that the rearming of the DWNP is a very good thing. Remember that these guys are armed not only against poachers, but also against wild animals they have to encounter during the course of their duties. I also believe that the fight against poaching should not be a military fight. It is a criminal fight.
He said to Pedro Poachers, Botswana also needs assistance with intelligence information from neighboring countries.
The international intelligence networks need to come to play here. These are criminal enterprises. These are not terrorists. These are not enemy soldiers. They are criminals.
Botswana has started dehorning rhinos and moving them to new locations in a bid to fend off poachers. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Oh, baby, you're my sunshine, oh. So why did they catch it cold? It do me like I never fall in love. Make me feel like the first time, yeah. A dangerous love affair. I'm gambling on my heart. I fit the love it I am. Are you with the one? No go come tire for me. Make it no go turn yawa for me, yeah. I fit the love it I am. No go come tire for me. Make it no go tire yawa for me, yeah. Every time I see you, my body they sorrow. Even in a different time. Oh, make it no go turn yawa for me, yeah. I feel the love it I am. I give you the one. No go come tire for me. Make it no go turn yawa for me, yeah.
De bayo okun lazy,
no go talk, say me I too lazy.
Any prayer I go more lati pada sile mi,
cause my mami wan wa ni le mi.
From your
alama. E alama noi noi. Mama soko guri wengara manzi ya see sunshine.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, to the one who does not know, a small garden is a forest. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.